came through looking like some villains.
What's up, everybody? You are listening to Big Chillin', the number one podcast in Hartsville, South Carolina. If this is your first time listening to us, let me brief you first to say, welcome to the family. I appreciate your listen. I got a very exciting podcast in store for you today. Here at Big Chillin', we haven't done a podcast here in a while, but I'm happy to announce that this episode right here will be the first to kick off our season. I couldn't think of a better guest to have on. This man has been a huge mentor to me throughout my 4 years at Coker University. He got his PhD at Texas A&M University. He is currently the assistant professor of sociology and criminology and the coordinator of the sociology program. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Danny Malone Jr. Dr. Malone, thank you for being here.
Wow. Thank you for such a kind introduction, Zach. I really appreciate it. And to be the first person on your new season of Big Chillin'. I think it's a long time coming. And so I'm excited to be here. I think this is great. I think, you know, people will get a sense of not just Dr. Malone, but Danny, you know, particularly Danny McCree's points. I like to say, just so people can kind of get the different layers to my personality and my person. So I'm excited to be here.
Yes, sir. Thank you for being here, and thank you for being so cool Tuesday. I know we tried having a go at this and had some technical difficulties. I made sure I made the listeners know that, don't worry, Thursday we're doing it. So I appreciate you, and thank you for working with me.
Oh, yeah.
So, Dr. Malone, about a month ago, you had broke some news on Facebook. Mm-hmm. You know, for 6 years, you've been able to call Hartsville and Coker your home.
Yeah.
And you broke some news that this would be your last semester here at Coker University. And you've done so much for this program. You've really impacted and touched a lot of students' lives in so many great ways. And while it's very sad that this is your last semester, it's also very exciting because you're going to Coastal University, Coastal Carolina University. So my question to you is, as one chapter closes, how cool is it to open a new one and to go somewhere and, you know, leave your mark there as well?
Well, yeah. So, for those who don't know, you know, I've recently accepted a position at Coastal Carolina University as assistant professor of sociology. And so, my time here at Coker has been, tremendous. I think overall, you know, I've been able to do what I love, which is, teach, serve others. And then also as a scholar, be able to research and publish, and actually had a great opportunity to publish with one of my former students. And so as I'm thinking about this time, as I'm getting ready to close out my time at Coker, you know, I do look at just kind of the big picture of the idea of the mantra here, that it's your story, right? So what is my story here at Coker? Well, you know, I was a young, hungry PhD candidate. I came out here after being recruited by a former associate, and I came right in just ready to teach, ready to change the programs that I was involved in. I saw a lot of potential, but I knew there was some kind of research I needed to do on the history of the programs, how they were set up, and then what could be my own kind of imprint that would improve the quality of the programs. And so what I remember is like my first summer here, so I earned my PhD my first year here, so I was balancing doing a dissertation while also teaching four classes. Serving on committee, so it was a lot for a young faculty member, but you know, you do what you got to do. So I earned the PhD, and then that summer, I remember just looking up some of the best programs, particularly criminology, that was my focus at first. Some of the best programs, kind of what were they doing, what were their program assessments doing, and also looking at some of our annual assessments. So for a lot of folks who are in academia, they're like, why is a first year, going to second year, faculty member, doing all of this? Well, because I care about what I do, and I'm learning like what it really means to be a faculty member, someone that's invested. So I look at these programs, I look at some of the commonalities, what they're doing as far as classes, what are ways that they're doing direct evidence of learning and then indirect evidence of learning. And then what I saw in our programs was that there were some voids, some things that weren't up to par in my opinion. And so what I did was, okay, I wrote a proposal like to my program right at the beginning of my second year, like, hey, like 9 pages of like, here's what we're doing right now. Here's what we should be doing to align ourselves, to position ourselves to be a really thriving program. And so again, this is my second year. You know, we had a new department chair because the one that hired me retired. And so, you know, it took a lot for them just to kind of let me do my thing. And then we just started laying stuff out. We, you know, I took over the capstone for the first time, which you took last year.
Yes, sir.
So you're my last iteration, which is a lot better than the first. But there had to be a first, at least for me. I changed the face of the capstone to actually have it reflect what students should be doing in a senior level capstone. I introduced criminological theories of crime as a way to supplement our intro to criminology. And I thought these two courses alone would help change the rigor and increase the quality of program. And then also a big part of that is recruiting faculty. And so as years went on, what was it, maybe 2019 is when we brought in Dr. Piatok. Mm-hmm. And she's been an invaluable asset.
Been awesome. Great. Phenomenal.
I mean, you know, in her second year, she earned Master Professor of the Year, which is like the top honor for a professor.
Right.
And, you know, it's been great to call her friend. And then, you know, for her to say that, you know, I was her mentor as well. I'm like, okay, cool. Like, that's awesome. And then bringing on Professor Domahedi the following year. And they've been a great asset as well. And so criminology, as you're being a criminology student, the program is just really taking off. It's popular. It's always been a popular one here at Coker, but I think the big thing is these different rankings that the program is hitting, given that we have 4 full-time faculty members and a large number of students that we all advise, along with the help of our student success coach and Mr. Dick Coldwell. And so hitting these rankings and doing all this and seeing the fruits of my labor from that first summer means a lot to me. Because people don't know how much work I did trying to really build this out for the whole of the program. Because it wasn't about me, it was really about the program. And so as I think about my 6 years, that's the good stuff, right? That's I've been able to do that with students. And then there's also challenges, being a young faculty member, being one that that's outspoken. And so in the academy, one of the things, and just like any job, you're quiet, you're encouraged to not say too much because you're new, you don't want to ruffle feathers. My personality is more of like, if I see something, I'm going to say something. In my first year, I didn't really say anything. But as I kind of caught on to how things, how things came about, I was like, okay, I'm noticing things, I'm going to have to say something. And I did have a situation earlier in my second year that did cause me to stand up and say something. Because it was regarding my review. And there were some inaccuracies, and I went through the proper challenges, did my best to address it. Long story short, I was found that I wasn't in the wrong in what I was saying. And had people, you know, admit that there were certain steps that weren't taken, should have been taken. And it was that kind of, one of those moments, those defining moments in my career where I was like, this is what it means to stand up for something, to stand up for yourself. But what that does, it caused tension because I bucked the system. But I was justified because had I not bucked the system, I would have not put myself, but I think I would have put my program in a, you know, not ideal situation. And so with that, that's also a part of my story here at Coker is, you know, being someone that's outspoken, that will buck when I have to. But it's not about my ego. It's about the program. It's about the others around me. Because if someone doesn't say something, then, you know, there could be dire consequences that aren't favorable. And so if I got to take on some vitriol for the good of the whole, then I'm willing to do that. And so, but those stories are far and few in between. But they do weigh heavy on me just because I'm like, ooh, did I roast one the wrong way? Well, how does that have ripple effects on different relationships? Because you also think about that too. And I did, and you just kind of take these things as they come. But as I leave, you know, Coker, like I'm leaving on very good terms. I've established some really good relationships with the faculty, but in particularly the students. That's one thing that I know as a, because I was a college student, at one time, right? having those relationships with students has been big for me. So going to y'all's sporting events, because y'all aren't just students, y'all are people. And I tell you all the time, like, just like as a professor, like I'm a person, right? Y'all are people too. So y'all are in sports, y'all got stuff in your lives going on. I don't know how many conversations I've had with students about different things going on in their lives, right? Because at the end of the day, my classes aren't going to matter. But what's going to matter is how it makes someone feel, you know, in those tough moments in their lives or in the high moments of their life. Did Malone show up? If he didn't show up, did he let me know why he didn't show up, right? So going to your sporting events, if I see you at your job, you know, just acknowledging your whole person. And so COVID allowed me to really develop, my person skills, right? My people skills, but also allowed me to kind of spread my wings as a person. And so as I move to Coastal, I want to bring all those same positive attributes there. And I don't know too much about the department over there more than it's just the people I've interacted with have been great. And I know they're excited to have me, and I'm excited to, jump in just like I did at Coker and, get my hands dirty and just kind of keep doing what I'm doing.
Yes, sir. I mean, there's no doubt that Coastal is getting a great professor, and I'm very thankful that, for your last semester, you teach me one more time. And that capstone class, that was really fun and challenging.
Yeah, get those pop quizzes, if you're not reading. But y'all, I think y'all only had one, if I'm not mistaken.
Two. It was two. One of them was for attendance, and then the other one you did give us, but you also did custom slack. Like, okay, I'll toss this one. This one out.
I enjoyed that class. Right, my last capstone, because I've done five of those. And
be honest, between me and you, just me and no one else listening. My capstone class was the best. It's okay to admit it. It's okay to admit it.
You gonna have those that first group, and you're gonna have them coming out saying, "Hold on," or even the group from last year. But y'all were a big group, so you have to remember. So that first time it was 16 students. But at that time, it was a lot of variation in respect to, like, there were crim students in it, it was like a psychology student in it, it was a sociology student in it, and it was just levels of knowledge in crim, so it was very uneven how I taught it. So that's why that class is special, because I really got through a lot of my own flaws and, insecurities as a professor, because it was the first time that I taught a senior level class, and these are these are seniors, and so I was super tough on them, but a lot of that, I think, a part of that was me trying to mask my own insecurities about teaching the class. And that's something I've told them, like, as they graduated and they moved on. Because, again, I was a young faculty member. Mm-hmm. A second-year faculty member teaching a senior-level capstone course is very intimidating. And I didn't have a baseline to teach. I literally created that baseline while I was trying to change the CRIM program. And so students, y'all don't see like a lot of the background stuff. So a lot of times people think, oh, they're just going and teach. I'm like, my job is so much more than teaching. It's prepping to teach. And I'm sure student athletes would appreciate that, because it's like, we see students, and I'm saying you, because you were a student athlete, right? At one time, that the practice, we don't see how many times you're getting taken down and da da da. We just may see the matches, but not all the prep work. Well, I'm saying keep that same energy for your professors. There's so much that you don't see, and that's just teaching. We're not even talking about the service, so serving on all these different committees, and also those of us who engage in academic research. There's so much that people don't see, which I think, contributes to, I'll just teach. It's like, I wish it was just teaching, because a lot of hours of my day would, be put elsewhere, but a good amount of our time is teaching, but we also do these other things. But to go back to the capstone, that first year, it was so uneven because I was dealing with different levels of expertise, blah, blah, blah. But by the time I got to y'all, literally most of y'all were crim majors, seniors, and I had a chance to cultivate y'all in these different classes. And then also with Dr. Piatak and then Professor Domhidi and Dr. Siegfried. So y'all had enough training to, when y'all got to the capstone, I didn't have to do too much kind of rehearsing. We could just kind of take off and then just continue to challenge y'all in these different areas in crim. And again, y'all rose to the top in those presentations. I know y'all love them.
they were something. They were definitely, I'm very thankful that I got through it. And, you know, obviously if I ever had any questions, I could always come to you and talk to you about anything. And you know, I'll talk to you about stuff. And you're like, oh, try going this way about it or do this, you know. Hands down, the capstone class was one of my favorite classes. Not just because of had to have you again, but also like the people in it. I feel like that might have been, like, of all my 4 years here at Coker, I feel like that capstone class was really, like, the closest I really, like, connected with a big group of people.
And I would say that's what made y'all unique, too, was that, and that was the closest I've seen, like, a capstone class. Like, and I always tell people this with Zach. Zach literally created a Snapchat group for that class. I'm like, one, that must have meant that they were really kind of like, oh, Malone is not playing. And Zach was like, I know Malone, so I'm going to go ahead and get the Snapchat together. I'm going to put us all in there, and we're going to keep each other accountable because I know with this capstone, you know, it's not a game. So I always tell that story, like, it was that series where I had a student, Zach, create a Snapchat or a group text or whatever and have everybody in it, like, hey, you know, make sure we read for this and all that because, you know, Malone might just throw something out there and da-da-da-da. And I'm like, that's how I knew that's what makes y'all special, unique in that sense that y'all were literally in it together. Like, hey, we all got to kind of go through this. So let's all just kind of help each other out. And that's a good approach because it's to life in general, right? Because no one does this stuff alone. And so you might as well try to find those that, you know, you can align with, lay out things together and just kind of go through it. So I always tell people that story. And I always tell people that story.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it was. The group chat was for, because a lot of times students, you know, even though, you know, you're very open and, you know, you're easy to talk to and ask questions for, sometimes students, like, maybe they're in a rush to go somewhere and they can't talk to you after class. So a lot of it was for, you know, hey, like, if they didn't want to ask a question, they could ask in the group chat. Or, you know, if we had those readings that we had to do, it would be, hey, you know, Monday we're going over chapter 7 through 12. Make sure you know it. Make sure you go. Make sure you read it. But yeah, no, that was a fun class, and there was a lot of memories made in that class. I don't want to say I wished it was longer, but
I don't know if you're curious, but I don't know if you're saying they wish it was longer.
Probably not. No.
So what? So if you can tell the audience, like, what is like one of your kind of favorite memories from that course? Oh, man. Look at it, put them on the spot, y'all.
There were so many. I think it was really fun doing the whole group projects. Whenever we're doing the PowerPoints and stuff like that, because, you know, I remember, like, I think Jordan's group I went first, and she had implemented the Kahoot in her PowerPoint, and I was like, when I looked at James and Cameron, I was like, let's do a Kahoot.
Hey, sometimes you gotta borrow a thing about this. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about going last, right? You can see what everybody's doing, and you can kind of mix and match, and then, hey, now it's your time, and bam. Yeah, y'all were really competitive. That's the thing. Yeah, with those Kahoots or whether it was the Jeopardy.
We did look out for each other that one time for Jeopardy. Because I remember we were, I think, we might have been a tie.
Yeah.
Or something like that. And you were just like, no, like, I'm going for the tie. Go for the win. And we were just like, no, if we can both get points, we're called the tie.
But again, that shows how close y'all were. You know, y'all were competitive, but it was like, look, we've been through a lot in this classroom alone, you know. And you know what? We'll all take less so we can all win. And I think that talks about your character, right? Like, it could have been cutthroat and like, no, dude. Y'all was like, look.
I want the 5 points.
Oh, right. Like, you know what? We can always get 2.5 and it is what it is, right? And so that was, again, I appreciate that. That shows, you know, again, that same character of that particular capstone. So. But yeah, no, it was a lot of great memories in that class with y'all. When we watched the documentary, Tough Guys, that whole discussion, Tough Guys 2. That whole discussion. It was just a lot of discussion. I didn't have to do too much pulling teeth, which is great for a professor. I like the sound of my voice, but I'm more interested in what y'all have to say, you know, how you integrate the readings, how do we connect that to what's going on in the world, and things of that nature. So definitely memorable class. And just having those, like I said, 16 of y'all. Who knows if I'm gonna have a class where it's like 16 students. I might, at this point, I may have it double.
Right, yeah.
And so that's a unique feature that, you know, I'm going to miss. Just because you get a chance to, you know, get the you have the opportunity to connect with each individual student. So where it's just not numbers, like, you know, I know stuff about all y'all's lives, not because I poke and prod it, because like you said, I've been open and easy to talk to, that students, I've gained students' trust, and they know I'm going to go and like spread people's business, because that's not what I do. Professionally, I shouldn't do that, but personally, I do my best not to do that. And so, you know, it's good to know y'all as individuals. And so that's been pretty cool.
I think, you know, through the capstone and over the past 4 years that I've had you, I've learned so much from you. But I think one of my favorite Malone quotes is always keep that same energy. Always keep the same energy.
You know, yeah. So you know, I told you, you know, the thing is, in life, you're going to have just moments where, you know, your foot's going to be to the fire, or you have to make tough decisions. And, you know, when I say, you know, keep that same energy, you know, what I'm saying is, like, let's say you start something, right? And you get down in the dumps and you might want to give up. Like, no, like when you're in the beginning, you were like gung-ho, you wanted to do it. I need you to keep up with that. But then the other side of keep that same energy is like when you get into some stuff you're not supposed to get into, but you had all the energy to do it when it was all cool, but now that you got in trouble, no, you know, keep that same energy when it's time to be held accountable. And a funny thing is, I say, when we say keep that same energy, when I was a kid and I get in trouble and, you know, before I get a whooping, my mom's like, you know, my mom or my dad like, no, you weren't crying when you was doing what you, you know, when you was out there doing what you weren't supposed to do, don't cry now, which is keep that same energy.
Right.
You know,
translation, keep that same energy.
Yeah. So when you was out there doing what you weren't supposed to do, and you didn't have a care in the world, well, now you're about to face the consequences, and I want you to keep that same energy. Now, of course, it's tough to keep that same energy when you know you're about to get a whooping. You're going to muster energy to cry aloud. Hopefully, it reduces the amount of the swats you get. But even in those, are funny because, you know, your parents can kind of tell, like, oh, you acting. Oh, you think, oh, you Denzel now, huh? And you're just making it worse. And so, you know, you just kind of, you know, let that happen and move on. But yeah, I think a lot of times we, you know, we do a lot. And then when it's time to pay the piper, so to speak, or time to face the consequences, it's just like, oh, no, like, you know, don't be so rough. Like, well, you know, when you were out there doing it, you weren't worried about the consequences. So now when it's time to pay, it's no. And so that's at least for me. You know what? If I'm going to be bold and do this, that, and the third, then I got to be ready for what comes with that. And so, keeping that same energy. So, and even when it comes to my professional life, things I got to do, you know, even with moving forward, the energy I had here, it goes with the same energy I'm going to bring at Coastal. And a lot of that is just, you know, I think a lot of that just comes with my upbringing, just the idea of no one's going to give you anything. I think at least with my background, with my parents, I owe a lot to my mom and my dad for just raising me with both, as I always tell, you know, I talk to my students and just people in general. I got a lot of book sense because my mom was really hard on us having education, college important, and all that, and that's because she was a teacher herself. And her generation, she was the first to go to college and all that. And so, and then for my generation, I'm the first to do it all, like go to college, go into the PhD. So education is important, all that type of jazz and book smarts. But there's also, you know, the street smart stuff. It's, you know, you can't, like my dad said, you're not going to learn everything in a book. You actually have to be out and be around people and have different experiences. And you put those two together, I'm going to be a problem everywhere because I just don't have the book smart. I got a decent amount of street smarts. I underplayed a lot, but it's there. And I have that. That's for both my parents, my mom and dad, and trying to cultivate that in me. And so that hustle in me to try to, you know, do what I can for my family, that's one reason why I'm going to keep that same energy when I'm doing anything. So when I'm in the classroom, like there could be days where I don't feel like it, but y'all will never know because it doesn't matter. Like y'all are there to, you know, take in what I'm given. So it doesn't matter if I'm feeling crappy or like, I got to show up and get it done. And so if I can do it on my bad days, imagine what I'm doing when I'm like hitting on all cylinders. And I'm just going to keep, you know, pushing it. So I would tell everybody, you know, just, you know, yeah, you got to keep that same energy because you're not going to be able to always feed off your environment. And I learned that not only in grad school, but in my professional capacity here is that, you know, I think people around me feed off of me because, I'm a natural giver and energy. But, you know, there are times where I have to sit back and go, oh, I need to kind of chill because I'm being overstretched, overextended. And if you drain yourself so much, you won't have enough to pour into, you know, just you should always have enough energy to pour back into yourself. Because if you can't pour into yourself, then it's going to be almost impossible for me to really pour into others. Or at least be as effective as I feel like I should be. And so I've learned to kind of sit back and recharge, you know, because you can be extroverted and be out there and do all that, but it can also burn you out. And so as I've gotten older, I would tell people growing up, like I was bashful, shy, I guess you could say introvert to some degree. And the way I rationalize it is I became an extrovert to survive. Because squeaky wheels get oiled. So can't help me if you don't say anything. And so I started to speak and started to do these things. And people tell you, like, Danny wasn't, like, he was in the books. Like, I knew about street stuff, but I was definitely not going to get in that because I've seen enough with my own family in prison to, like, okay, this ain't the route. This is not the route. But, you know, I stayed quiet, I paid attention to my surroundings, and then just kind of grew confident in myself and then started to speak more. But then as I got older, I was like, okay, you don't always have to speak. You don't always have to be in the mix and to know about everything. So as I got older, I become kind of a bit more reserved to where I would say I'm an ambivert. So there are times where I know I need to be extroverted, blah, blah, blah. But then there are times where I'm like, I'm going to let someone else be the extroverted person. I'm just going to sit back so I can, you know, retain my energy. But then also now I'm a father too. And so I'm like, I can't be giving everybody all the energy because my daughter Chanel deserves, you know, that same energy or if not more. And so I've also kind of learned how to kind of tame that in.
Yes, sir. You know, so you're right. One of the things I've learned about you over the years is that you were born in California.
Mm-hmm.
You were raised in Houston, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up, like, who were your biggest influences and who inspired you the most as a kid? And so even now.
Okay. Yeah. So I was born in Los Angeles, California. So my mom was born and raised in Watts. My father is from Long Beach and still resides in Long Beach. And so my mother moved to Texas right around, I guess I was two, and then my little brother was born in Houston shortly after, and so we're about 60 months apart, if I'm mistaken. And so, so Houston's home. I love it. So, you know, people hear me shout out Greens Point, and that's a particular part of the greater Houston and North Side, where I learned a lot of my life lessons growing up. And so if you're talking about, and I like to talk a little bit about growing up, like I think I had a decent upbringing. My parents, you know, scrapped, did what they had to do. My mom, I got to watch my mom graduate from college. Like, and so that was like what, in the first grade or so, right before first grade. So I got to watch her graduate from the University of Houston with a bachelor's degree, and she began teaching. Right after that. And then, you know, shortly after I had my other younger brother. And so she grinded. My dad, he just grinded. He had odd jobs in and out. And really just gave me the idea of, like, you have to work for your keep. So watching both of them hustle and do their thing really, you know, inspired me to this day. And that's part of the reason why I think I always have a chip on my shoulder, always wanting to grind, because I watched them do it. You know, my dad worked in kitchens, you know, worked in his kitchen. He's a really good cook. Worked in kitchens. I was a kitchen inventory agent at Marriott for years. He was like a supervisor, like something like an egg and I. So he's always, you know, been a grinder. So I never looked down on any type of job growing up, because I knew sometimes you gotta work your way up. But if you're talking about like people I looked up to, so, you know, both my parents, they have, you know, these particular qualities about them. Like I said, my mom's big on education. Both of them disciplined. My dad, definitely disciplinarian of the family. And so for him, and so when I talk about my dad, I got to make a distinction. So obviously I'm a junior, so my father, named after my father, but my father's not who raised me. My dad is Terry Lynn Stewart Sr. So that's my dad. You know, people say stepdad's my dad. Since two, he's been the man that's really forged a lot of my morals and beliefs. And so when you talk about looking up to someone, watching him, you know, take me and my brother on, you know, as his own. He has he had a daughter before he even met my mom. And so my sister, Misha, didn't live in the same household as us, but, you know, taking his own as his own. So when we would go to like the park with his friends and stuff, you know, these are my sons. And that was before TJ, who was named after him, was born. So it was tough at first because, you know, like, who's this dude? You know, my mom, da-da-da. But I just remember over time just watching like what he did for us. Really, you know, now older, I really appreciate it. Then it was kind of tough. It's like, oh, he's mean, da da da, getting whooping, da da da. But he would explain why things were going on, and he was really hard on us. Like the idea of like fights, like that, you know, for the internet, like one of these little memes I see is like, a lot of y'all grew up fighting on the internet in the streets, and it shows.
Yeah.
Like we were fighting in the streets.
It wasn't no internet stuff.
There was no internet stuff. Like it was
Twitter thugs.
No, right, right, right. Yeah. You know, e-thugs and you know, keyboard wars and all that. Like, no, like people were literally bringing things to your front door. Now, I wouldn't say they're doing today's age. Now they trespass. Like, oh, you know, then, you know, that kind of jazz. But we were taught that, you know, you don't let people walk in your grass. And if they do, tell them to get off. And if not, then, you know, you are supposed to, like, you know, handle it. And so we weren't taught to be like the aggressors or bullies, but we also weren't taught to be punks. And for those that hear the word punks, this is not talking about sexual orientation or anything like that. So for us, my dad said, you know, a punk is someone who doesn't stand up for themselves. They allow people to bully them and pick on them and all that type of jazz. And you just, you know, you get punked. And that was not something he wanted us to do. Because if you were allowed that now, imagine what happens when you get older.
Right.
Either you're going to become a bully or you're just going to continue to get punked. And so there are literally fights that we would get into, you know, with other kids around the neighborhood, lose and win fights. You had to, like in my front yard and other people's front yards. And that's not for me to be like, oh, like I was really bad, because I wasn't. I knew I had to fight. Right. It's not like I wanted to go out and pick fights. Like, you had to, because where I grew up, if people find out that they could punk you, guess what? They're going to spread it to other people. And guess what? Other people are going to try you. And I, you know, people pull up to our, you know, knock on the door, like, hey, we're about to fight. You had to fight. Like, because the thing is, my dad was like, you're not going to run in this house. Either you get your ass whipped out there or here, which one you want? That's literally what, you know, right, what he said. So it was more honor to take it out there. And then, you know what? You know, you fought, you didn't run. So you can respect that. And so, you know, dealing with that growing up, that's how I knew early on about the whole idea of just standing for something and fighting. So people pull up to our door. I have to go to some people's doors if, you know, something's going on. So like, look, we need to address this because there's clearly something going on.
Right.
And those are, you know, those are a few things that happened, you know, growing up. And I think about it now, it's like, I'm too old. I'm not even trying to find nobody in the day and age. But when people, you know, kind of look at, like, Dan, you know, he's so kind and smile, like, but like, Dan was out there fighting just like every other kid. Because one of the things that I've dealt with in my life is like, oh, Dan's a goody two shoes. I was like, I don't particularly agree with that assessment, but people can have that opinion. There people grew up and say, yeah, Danny was in his books. He wasn't really out there like trying to, you know, get into stuff. You know, part of that is true. Another part of that is if you put that jacket on me, and particularly for my parents, I told my dad earlier, why wouldn't I wear it? Because guess what? If things are going on, you would never suspect me. Because you've already said that, hey, Danny's a good two shoes, you would never do that. So then I'm just going to use, I'll just use that to my advantage.
Right.
So just like any other kid growing up, get into fights, do that jazz. School was always important. So bring on the A's. This is back when Blockbuster was open.
Yeah.
And you, three E's, we can get a video game for like a weekend.
Kind of came at the end of Blockbuster. Oh, yeah. I remember it, you know.
Yeah, so we used to do that. You know, pizza that ran the promotion for the pan pizza stuff. So, you know, at least try to do that. But yeah, so if you're talking about my parents are definitely a big part of it. I would say another person in this historical figure is Dr. Martin Luther King. And I think a lot of that was just, you know, stuff that we're fed through school initially, you know, just about like what he stands for, blah, blah, blah. But also he had doctor on his name. I was like, it'd be cool to have doctor in front of your name. So, and that was me very young. So I kind of knew like in my mind, like I wanted to have a DR in front of my name just because Dr. Martin Luther King had it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was someone I looked up to. If you want to talk about like entertainers and stuff like that, I mean, I grew up in, I think, a great era of hip hop and rap. So, though I had parents that were very big on, like, not really letting us listen to stuff, because I remember, like, when, like, so let's say something like Jenna Juice came on.
Right.
And parents were like, you sing them lyrics to that? You better sing them down at ABCs. Like, you know, and my dad would get on and was like, what's this and this? Like, I don't want y'all listening to that crap, and you don't know the important stuff.
That's crazy.
So, I remember him really being on us about that. But then also the idea of my dad recognizing early, like, okay, I'm raising these two black males in America. There's this, he knows what was out there. He knew what was out there for us. He had to navigate it, but he's like, I have to try to protect them the best way I can. And one of it, to loop it back around, is I have to be hard on them because they're going to be in a world that will be hard on them, and they have to be able to know how to deal with it. And so that was another part of the upbringing, too, is understanding the sense of what it means to be black in America, particularly being a black male in America. But also my dad would tell you, even with all this stuff, it doesn't matter. You still have to get stuff done. So if anything, if you have all the stuff going against you, you must be a damn threat. So try to find a way to do some reverse psychology. That you must be pretty strong if you got all these different things trying to keep you down. There has to be something. So try to use that to your advantage. And so MLK, parents, entertainers. So I like Biggie and Tupac. You know, they had this swag, this bravado about them that I liked. And I'm like, this kid that's like in the books and stuff, like that's not really me, but I like it. You're right. And so hip hop entertainment, comedians, you know, watching shows like The Wayans, I mean, maybe your generation probably more of Scary Movies and how y'all know Sean and Marlon. I know him from The Wayans Show,
yeah.
From Living Color, and
White
stuff
chicks.
Like that.
Making my way down.
Like MC Hammer broke. Yeah, so again, yeah. And so so entertainers are a big part of my upbringing as well. Just as I thought, you know, as a kid, I thought I'd be like an actor. I was like, you know, this is pretty cool, be on TV, people see you. I like making people laugh. But it's not something that, you know, I really end up pursuing. Like I did theater like in like middle school. But I was more in the, I did it, I was like, I didn't really care too much.
You wanted the cool stuff, the action stuff, comedy stuff, you know?
Yeah. But I actually ended up doing debate. In 7th, 8th grade, I did debate. And won like second place in district, so it was pretty cool to do that. And so, trying to think, what else can I tell you about my upbringing? So I'm the oldest. So in the household, there's three boys. I'm the oldest. You got my brother Nick, who's about 16 months younger than me, and then TJ, who's about 7 years or so younger than me. So we just, you know, I mean, we all grew up in that house, and as I tell you all in class, my dad went away for a year and some change, and then came back during our childhood, and that really kind of changed me too. So not having him there and seeing other family members, you know, doing time and things of that nature, really, you know, kind of flipped my switch, and as far as like being independent, having to, you know, do things and feel like you have to do more for folks. And that also included my brother. So I was trying to be protective of them. So me taking on more so that they didn't have to, that was kind of like something I just increasingly did as we grew up. And so me and my brother, Nick, we'd have our little fights here and there. He is definitely the more, he's outgoing, you know, the jokes are the family. You know, the people say, I guess, like the rebel, like he's going to push the envelope on a lot of things. And so there's stories for days between me and him. And then you have TJ, who's more reserved. You won't hear too much about him. he stays out the mix. He stays out the way, which is great. But again, he was like 7 years younger. So as I was going into high school, becoming more independent, had a job working, he was like pretty much by himself because Nick had went to California to live with our father. So he was really by himself a lot of times. And then I went to college. And so he really, you know, it's kind of like an only child, right? Because he, you know, his brothers weren't really around. So I feel for him in essence. So like as an older brother, it's like, I should have been doing more. But I can see, at least even with me being away, some of my qualities that he has made him, you know, great, even better than me. What else can I give you as far as my upbringing? There's still people from, like, you know, when I grew up that I still talk to through via like social media and stuff like that. I wonder what they think now, kind of like, you know, again, if we're talking about Danny's in the books, you know, I don't know if people say I'm geek or nerd. Like, I was just smart. Like, you know, I was smart. I knew stuff. I think I was probably like a know-it-all. Like, I was like, oh, you know, I like want to correct things, da da da. And, you know, that can rub people the wrong way. Yeah. But as a kid, I'm not really understanding that. I'm thinking, oh, I'm smart. I'm about to flex on these people. And sometimes those can cause fights and stuff too. Because somebody's like, I'm going to shut this person up, or you think you know everything. But as I got older, I finally got the context, like, hey, that's not going to, you know, that ain't always cool. So I dealt with that, you know, the whole idea of, you know, being smart and people sometimes using that against you, or that wasn't always like a great quality. You need to mask that. So I had that period of time where, you know, I was like, let me get a C in a report card, and it shows up cool. My mom's like, what are you doing? Like, you better stop that. Like, that's like, be who you are. That's not you. You're not a C student. Like, don't. I remember that.
You're like, you know what? I'm getting a C.
I'm getting a C because again, this is the pressure of trying to conform and feel like you need to be in and all stuff, but. Right. You know, so that's me in middle school. That's grown folks still doing that. Like, that's the problem. Still trying to fit in. All right. And so, we talk about upbringing. Like, I think it was cool. It had its challenge. Like I said, there's fights, there's things, you know, with parents and trying to find your identity and who you are and what you're about. When I remember when I got my job, at Little Caesars, that was my first job. I had my car and I'm driving to work. It's a couple of minutes from the house and just like, yeah, I got my own money. I ain't asking anybody for nothing. Da, da, da. And I mean, I really kept that same energy. And so you can go to my parents and ask them how many times has Danny ever asked money for us since like pretty much since he had a job. I don't like, I try to be very independent, but I also realized over time that being highly independent at a very young age is actually like a trauma response to like, you know, whatever you were experiencing. And so I didn't really understand until I was an adult. So just the idea of like, you know, it was something that was cheered, like, oh, he's very self-sufficient, da, da, da. But in actuality, it's a trauma response. So the question becomes, why did he feel like he needed to be so independent so early on, not to be a burden on anybody? Because I was cheered, I was praised for all that. And I thought it was good, so I was like, this is why Danny don't trust too many people, right? Like, and this is where I want to get students and people to think about, like, introspection, right? Into stuff like that. Like, why are we the way we are? You know, what are the experiences that we've taken from childhood that are unresolved and that they just manifest in different ways, whether it's your job, whether it's your personal relationships, and blah, 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 blah. But yeah, so a lot of stuff in my childhood, I can tell you, I mean, I have stories for days about it, but I wouldn't make anything different though, because they've all really pushed me to be who I am today. And So that's why I have so much pride when I talk about Greens Point or Aldean ISD, which is a school district I spent most of my life in. All those experiences have allowed me to be who I am today. And so when I'm on Facebook and I share stuff and there's people like from, you know, from where I'm from, and I can tell like a lot more proud of me, you know, not just, you know, that I got the PhD and blah, 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 and doing my job, but the way in which I carry myself, I've kept the same energy. Like, you know, they're essentially the same person, except he's just very bold about it now. And that's something my dad took him some time to figure out. So he's kind of always been like this. He was just very quiet about it as a kid. But now that he's kind of like in this space, he's super bold about it. But the thing about it is that, damn, he's bold in the space where people could demonize him for being this way. But he doesn't care. Like, because this is who he is. Like, if he's doing his job, then what? Then what's the real problem? So then then I just volley to you. So what's, you know, in general. So what's the real problem with Danny presenting himself this way? And then that's where people are like, you need to check yourself. What's going on? If I'm not affecting your bottom line and your day to day, then what's it to you?
Why does it matter? Exactly. You know, I mean, that's something I never understand too, is, you know, people can hate on someone, but if they're not bothering you or they're not doing anyone hurting anyone, just let them be. You know what I mean? You know?
Yeah, you know, haters gonna hate. That's the thing. You know, naysayers gonna naysay. But the thing is, and I've heard this from this podcast, $1 million worth of game. You know, you gotta let haters be your market. That's marketing campaign. Because guess what? There might be people that have never heard about you, but they heard about you now because of a hater.
Right.
And chances are, you got people who will use critical thinking, like, is this really true? And then they go start looking at, like, well, from my vantage point, this person ain't nothing like what you're talking about. Now I'm gonna be a fan of this person because, you know, a hater gave you some free market. So my thing is, like, you know, haters, you know, God's put special cheerleaders here in the form of haters. And so I'm gonna let you go ahead and hate, you know, because that's what you do. Go ahead and hate, you know. My thing is, you don't have to like me, but don't lie. You know, and it's something else, my mom and my dad, you know, like, everybody's not going to like you. They didn't raise me to think that everybody should like you, mm-hmm. right? Because you're going to have certain positions that are just quite different than others, and it might cause them not to like you. But there should be no situation where you feel like it's okay for someone to lie on you. That, like, that's not okay. And so there are plenty of people I don't like. But I'm not going to go in and lie on you. I'm just like, hey, there's just a difference in preference and styles and blah, blah, blah. And that's cool. You can have your preferences, right? Like, that's just because I don't like it doesn't mean I think you're less of a person. I like something that you do. And there's plenty of stuff that personally tell me, I don't like that you do that. Okay, cool. I'm probably still going to do it.
Right. Exactly.
And you get to choose if you want to be around me or not.
Right.
And there's the things I've done with other people. I may not like that you do A, B, and C. And if I could justify it, because it can have negative impact, And then there could be some things where, hey, I got to cut this relationship off because you have not listened to what I had to say and how these things have impacted me and blah, 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 blah. And that's cool. But as far as this whole idea of, like, wanting likes and validation, that's one of the things I don't like about social media, is that, you know, people are chasing likes. You're literally chasing likes.
And you know the thing about social media is, like, nothing's ever what it's like, what it seems. You know what I mean? Someone could post their Florida, wherever, like, their life's this great.
Mm-hmm.
When in reality, like, they could be depressed or not happy where they're at in life. But, you know, I think social media's kind of gotten to where, like, you don't post the bad things, right?
No, so yeah, it's just a highlight reel.
It's always, yeah, the highlight reel.
So what you're saying is a lot of capping and captions, huh?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, I've met some people personally that do that. You know, they're not happy where they're at in life, but because, you know, especially around my age, you know, people who go through relationship breakups, you know what I mean? They're missing that person, but they'll be like, you know what? Nah, I'm doing good without you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You gotta pose. You gotta put on a front.
Right.
Because again, you want to keep up with the Joneses. You don't want anybody to see you down, because we have used social media as a way to say, here's a broadcasting of our highlight of our lives, that everything's always up. Da, da, da. And that's unhealthy, because, you know, because not everything is highlight reels, mm-hmm. right? And you do have those people who do have vulnerability moments, and they'll express them authentically. But then there's also people who manufacture vulnerability moments.
Right.
Because again, they're still trying to seek the validation.
The likes and
yeah, and so I try to look at everything from all different perspectives. Because I'm pretty active on social media, and I would like to think there's no cap in my rap.
No.
But again, like you said, you just never fully know what's going on in someone's life, because we're getting what you want people to see. Mm-hmm. You're creating your own. It's your digital self. Like, how do you want yourself to be presented online? And I know, like, because I can't imagine having social media when I was like 10, 11, 12, 13, whatever. I didn't have any social media until like, what, my senior in high school, almost?
MySpace?
So we had MySpace, you know, top eight, and that was always a big thing. If somebody was in your top eight friends, something like that, they want to get their feelings about it. And then Facebook, I remember, it was called The Facebook, and you had to have a college ID. Like, you couldn't.
Oh, wow.
So you had to have a college address to get on thefacebook.com. So I didn't have Facebook until I got my official email from Texas A&M. And so then I jumped on the Facebook. And I didn't have too many. I had initially a few pictures, and then as I got into, you know, as we started moving to college and all stuff, then I started documenting different pictures and stuff like that. And I get those memories pop up. Some of the things I cringe, not because it was bad. It's like, man, Danny, you really was like trying to be a philosopher. Like, you know, like, I guess that's just part of like, I really just have these deep thoughts about life. Like,
right,
did you have to necessarily put that on Facebook? And it's just, you know, looking back now, popping like, oh, 12, 13 years ago, like, yeah, I wouldn't do that today. Like, I wouldn't post that today. But 06, 07, I did. But one thing I never did is I didn't post any incriminating stuff. I didn't,
right.
Yeah, I didn't do any of the goofy stuff that I see students do too often. I didn't see even professors that you end up losing your job because you're doing too much for the gram or then you put it on Snapchat and it goes away. Like, no, like that stuff is on a server somewhere. So I always tell students and just be aware of what you put out there. So even like this podcast, right? So I'm doing my best to measure words and things of that nature. And I'm speaking in the capacity as a private citizen, because I am a whole person outside of my identity as a professor. Because again, you can, you know, people could take one snippet and replay it a certain way and turn into something that's not. And then next thing you know, you're out there. You're out of there. Because we are in a space where people like, I'm all about accountability, but I feel like some people really overdo it. They're like, we want to chastise and punish you and get you out of there because there's some other agenda at play. And I'm just like, so when I see these kind of witch hunts going, I'm like, ooh, let me sit back. Because again, everything ain't what it seems. And so that's why I asked y'all in class, like, think about the who, what, when, where, and why. Like, these are some critical questions. Triangulate information, and then let's see if we can get to what's really going on. Are there agendas at play that you may not be aware of? Social media, man, it can be a great place to provide a lot of inspiration, but it can be a bad place too, because, you know, if someone has a fan base, you know, they can use that fan base against other folks, you know, doxing people,
right,
and like all this extra stuff that you can actually put people like at risk, you know. And you don't want to do that to anybody.
Yeah, I think, you know, social media is great, and it allows us to keep up with family and friends, and it is fun. Mostly I use social media. I don't have any posts on Instagram or anything, but I use it for like to keep up with sports and, you know, things of that nature. But yeah, I think it's important to, even though social media is great, I think it's also important to remember that that's not
real.
That's not reality. You know what I mean? Like, there's been so many times where, you know, I'll be at a hangout with friends or at a family event or, you know, and people are just like, they're not interacting face to face. Like they're on their phones. And sometimes it's just like, man, like, and I'm guilty of it too.
Yeah.
And it's just sometimes just like, you know, it's, I'll be on my phone and then I'll like be done with hanging out with the person. And I go home and I'm like, man, I didn't even like, should have like said more, done more,
I didn't even
live in the moment. And I think that's always important to remember to, like, you know, obviously if you got to be on your phone, but when it's time to communicate and talk and interact with the people, to do that, you know, to take the time to do things like that.
All right. No, I think that's that's quite important, like the idea of just living the moment. Because again, you know, the whole idea of having a phone internet access was something. I didn't have internet access to a phone until grad school. Like I had a phone, but it didn't have internet access. Like it was just literally a flip phone. It did what it was supposed to do, call in, call out. I don't even know if I had text. Yeah, so just the idea of always being connected is a thing, right? Where people like phones attached to the hip or like literally in your hands. I mean, I see y'all in my class, like I don't call y'all out by name, but literally, you know, you can see students like scrolling like
during the lectures,
during the class. I'm like, no, I'm not born, but it's literally like you can't stay off your phone.
Right.
It's addicting, right? It's like, can you cope without your phone? Like, can you literally have a challenge, like a 40-hour phone challenge? How many of us can really disconnect from our smartphones and all that with no internet access, no social media app access? I don't know how many of us can.
A lot of people would fail.
Because again, we're so connected, right? Because there's so many different social media apps, and we use them in different ways to where, you know, we've become codependent. I shouldn't say everyone, but a good amount of folks are codependent on social media. It's a way that we cope with the world around us, right? And then it goes back to the idea of, can I create a reality in which I'm the star? And that's the thing with social media, right? You can be the own star of your own show, and the ones that are really good at it, they're the ones that get the bag for you, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out what I can finesse the bag.
Get a little blue check mark.
Yeah, get a blue check mark so I can get some of those blue bills. You know?
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
That'd be really good. Really nice. Just make a post. People engage with it. Money in your account.
that'll work. I haven't figured that part out yet. But once I do, boy, y'all better watch out.
So, Dirk, one of the other things I always wanted to ask you, you know, so how did you become a professor? And what led you down that road to want to become one?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a really good question. So, here's where so I always talk a lot about my dad, right? He's a very big part of my life, but my mom's also a big part, and someone I do talk a little bit about too. So my mom's a teacher. Mm-hmm. Like she was a teacher for many years. She's an administrator now, but she had a very big influence, and I remember. So while she's a teacher, like I'm in class, like I'm at the same school where she's teaching at, so I'm seeing like how students interact with her. Like I know her as mom, but they know her as Mrs. Stewart. And so she was always popular at the schools that she was at. You know, students love her. Like, you know, as I grow older, middle school, so like, these are like my friends. So they know her as Mrs. Stewart. I know her as mom. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, Mrs. Stewart's my favorite. And they still talk about it to this day. And so I'm seeing all this growing up. And like, one, I wasn't going to make an impact in the world. I literally see my mom making an impact in these young, you know, folks' world who are also my friends. Some of them. Few y'all don't mess with. But I'm glad my mom had a great impact on me. I think that had a very big impression on me that I didn't really realize until like I got older and I got into school. But I always wanted to make an impact. And I also wanted to be in a profession where I could really just do me. And I think another part of this was not having representation like in the front of the classroom. Someone, not only who looked like me, because like that's a thing to some degree, but also someone who sounded like me, who carried themselves in the way that I carry myself. Because I know there's a lot of times in college where, like, I had professors and I seen professors who may look like me, but the way they did things was different and didn't always resonate with me. Now, that's what knocks them, because a lot of them are very professional. You know, they're professional, they're doing their things, and I have a lot of respect for them. But I didn't see anyone do it like the way that I think I'm doing it. And that's cool. That's, you know, I don't need anyone to be me. But I think there are a lot of students who may come from similar backgrounds who feel like they don't feel seen. And when there's someone in front of the room, they want someone that can communicate with them. And so part of my motivation was like, if I can make it through the ranks of grad school, when I'm a professor, I'm doing it my damn way. As long as I can read the contract and what I can and can't do, I'm going to do it my way. And so as I got through early in grad school, so I remember one of my first things was like, you know, I'm Dan from Greens Point, the way I have this kind of bravado I have, this confidence that I have that sometimes rubs people the wrong way, but, you know, don't let your insecurities, you know, not what I'm doing. You know, you need to address that. But But I remember in grad school, one of the first things was actually dealing with a student with one of my peers doing these little blogs, and this person was going after students of color. They went after two, and then they got to me. And they're like, they're not putting our names on it, but they're describing situations where I'm like, anyone that can read it will know exactly what they're talking about. And when they got to me, I said, oh, you want to do stuff behind the closed doors? Okay, cool. I went to Facebook. I literally tagged a person, called him a coward. I was like, you know, because you want to do this blog, you want to be anonymous? No. Keep that same energy. Keep that same energy. And so I remember, you know, one of my peers, because in this cohort, one of them DM'd me and was like, they was a professional and da da da. I said, I don't care. You don't go around making blogs about folks and making jokes and then get upset when I hold you accountable. You don't like that. You don't like that's your friend. I don't care. And so that was my first year in grad school. And I remember another associate was like, well, this is in Greenpoint. I'm like, I don't know what it is. Like, you don't disrespect people like that. And I felt like I was taking up for the other two individuals that were being spoken on, because they didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, because I guess they were kind of like, you know, we just don't let it slide because we don't want to ruffle any feathers. I'm like, no, Dave from Greenpoint. We don't. So the way I read it was, you trying to punk me. You can punk them other folks. You're not going to punk me.
Right.
And that's, you know, so that kind of probably kind of like that energy is what, you know, I want to kind of bring to academics. I think in a lot of ways, people try to be politically correct, or they try to, you know, politic, and they don't want to do anything. They're like, oh, I don't want anybody to have the stigma of me being urban. Da, da, da. I'm like, I am who I am. Just check my work. If my work isn't good, then let's have a conversation. But if not, I'm a rock, I rock. And that's just kind of how I carried myself. And I think there are a lot of people who would like to do that. And you don't have to be from an urban background like me. You could be, but they're so scared of being rejected or being ridiculed and da, 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 that they choose just to conform to whatever they feel like is this look of what it means to be successful. So that's also another part. It was like changing the look of what it means to be successful. So I tell y'all, like, you know, you've been in class with me. I use African American vernacular English. Doesn't mean I'm not successful. Doesn't mean I'm unprofessional. This is a way for me to communicate. And there will be students who recognize exactly what I'm doing. And guess what? They feel connected. And so in graduate school, I didn't have too many of those experiences where a professor could connect me in that way. Now, academically, yeah, like we can talk about these theories and theorists and these complex concepts. But when it came to just like person to person, I can't say I had like connections. And, you know, and that's something that as a professor, I want to make sure I could do with students. And it didn't matter what background you come from, I want to make sure I make connections with students. That doesn't mean that they weren't trying, just I didn't feel a close connection. And so we got my mother being the great teacher that she was, and then me knowing that I could be a great teacher, along with just having, I'm intellectually curious. That kind of really just pushed me into doing, you know, academia. So I go to grad school, I got a chance to teach a couple of classes, got a chance to do some research. And then I just made a decision, like, if I'm gonna get the DR, again, connect to MLK, let me go ahead and be a professor. And so as I went through college, I started engineering, then I kind of fell into sociology after taking a couple of classes from some great professors. I was able to, you know, do some research, undergraduate research, and then that kind of like, okay, I want to get more into this, so let me go to grad school. And if I'm going to grad school, then I'm go all the way through and get the PhD. So then I go to grad school, have different experiences, and I'm like, okay, well, now it's time to get a job. So then, I arrive here at Coker, and Coker's a definitely different place than Houston, definitely different place than Texas A&M, and I kind of knew early on I was going to have a different type of impact, because there was no one here on the staff faculty that brought it how I brought it. But I also knew there'd probably be some issues with that, because it's a rural area. I could see the divisions, along different lines. And just the expectations people have of a faculty member. I mean, y'all see the way I dress. That's not how I dress early on. I had the polo, khakis every day, you know, clean cut across the way. And then after about my first year, I'm like, nah, like, you know, sometime during my second year, I was like, no, like, I'm seeing people with jeans still on. Like, I'm wearing jeans. Like, it ain't gonna be just Jean Friday. Like, I'm just wearing jeans and all that every day. So then I just started doing that. And again, this is part of what I said earlier. Like, I had to kind of get a lay of the land. So the first year, I'm gonna play it very close. So I just need to see and feel things out. But as I got more comfortable and definitely more confident, I was like, okay, I'm gonna expand my wardrobe, just kind of be more casual. But then also to help students, because I'm casual, it's not so quote unquote intimidating. But also even my cadence and how I speak and things of that nature bring students in. And these are things that I just, in my opinion, I didn't see it in grad school. But you know, when I got here to Coker, I was like, okay, I'm probably the only one that's really doing it in all these different ways. And that will attract a lot of students. And I'm sure it got students to stay away from me, and probably till this day. And that's fine. Because I don't know what preconceived notions you may have had about someone who carries himself. I carry myself. And that's fine. Like, you know, just like I said, you ain't got to like me, just don't lie on me. But most students that have had me, like, my mom's cool. Like, he's good. He's going to push you. He's going to challenge you, da-da-da. I think I've probably had students that haven't ever said it to me. I'm sure they probably said the backdrop was like, maybe they don't like it for whatever reason. They have preference over other professors and all that. And that's cool. Everybody got their preference. My style, the way my presentation, it isn't for everybody. But it's authentic to me. And I think that's what really helped me in this profession, is that academia does give you that space to really, you can really be you, but you have to have the courage to be you. Because there is an inertia for conformity, like anything. So we can, sociologists, I can talk about conformity, group dynamics, blah, blah, blah. But in a lot of ways, people are just pushed to conform because it's being pushed to be accepted. And I'm not pushing to be accepted. I'm pushing to be me. You can accept it or not. And I'm hoping my students carry the same energy as they go out into the world. When y'all start feeling those different pressures to conform and things of that nature, don't conform to something if it's not going to benefit you. If it's going to harm you, do your best not to conform to it. Why would you conform to something that's going to hurt you at the end of the day? And so academia allowed me to really do that. If it didn't allow me, I made it. Right. I made it a point to just do it this way. And I've been successful thus far. Trust me, there's been plenty of people like, oh, you shouldn't do this. Just like incorrect. Oh, you should do that. You should do this. It's not going to work out. And all I do is do it. It works. And I just smile. Like, I'm not even going to throw it in your face. Because the actions speak for themselves. The fruits of my labor speak for themselves. So even if you talk about the job talk I did at Coastal, the same way in which I've talked about is exactly what I did. I mean, think about this. You have a job interview, you know, for a professor, and you go in and talk about pushing pee. Right, like, right. You think students aren't resonating with that? Now, maybe the search committee might not have known what I was talking about, but those students did.
Yep.
And the same reaction you had, like, they're like, oh, okay, you know, that you get some cool points on that, and it doesn't come off as cringe because I am who I am. Like, I give that energy off. Because you can have, like, if you have a different type of professor that you just push through, like, ooh, like, you're trying too hard, yeah. Right. And for me, it just comes so natural because, like, that's him. Like, and so, doing that on a job talk, a lot of people probably wouldn't do it. Like, oh, that's too colloquial, it's too urban, da da da. But whole time, that's probably one of the things they really loved about him, because we got that vibe from him. Like, this is him. It'll help the program, it'll help us. So it wasn't seen as a negative. But if you're talking about people coaching you up and stuff like that, they was like, ooh, don't do that. And I'm just like, some of y'all just don't want to take risks. I'm not a risk averse person. I've been taking risks my whole life. And sometimes I've lost, sometimes I won, but you have to take risks. To be great, you have to risk being misunderstood, you gotta risk being ridiculed, disrespected, and all that. But that's just comes with it. And so I'm chasing down greatness, which means I'm gonna have to take risks, I'm gonna have to do what others won't be willing to do, but also just have to stay true to myself. And that's something I wanna impart on my daughter, you know, as well. I don't want her to beat me, I want her to be better than me, but one of the things that I hope she does take is just the idea of, like, I'm going to have to take risks. I might be willing to lose in the short term to win in the long term. So also be thinking about the long game. And so far in academia, I've been able to do me, been able to be very successful here at Coker doing me. Doesn't mean I didn't make, I say enemies, but doesn't mean that, you know, people don't have issues with me, but I say you just approach me about it and address it. But I've been successful here, and I want to carry that kind of same thing over. And so as long as I'm able to do me, be successful, engage with students, be able to have great dialogues with colleagues and build something great, I'm going to be in academia. There are some people that I know that have left because it's just like any industry. It can be draining. You can see just the ugly side of things and just decide to leave and do other things. Also, things can become more lucrative if you leave academia based on, you know, where you are and things of that nature. So there have been plenty of people I know that have left, and they're very happy. But for me, the industry hasn't gave me some kind of indelible scar to where I'm like, oh my God, I want to leave. But just like in any industry, any job, you see the ugly underbelly, and you're just like, ooh, makes you think.
Right.
It makes you think. And I'm just like, right, for us, you know, at least for me, I'm like, I'm grateful that I've been able to be successful. I've been able to kind of now be able to make my first kind of academic move since grad school, right, to another place, and be able to do that because the market is really tight in academia, and so I'm blessed to be able to continue to move and continue to grow as a scholar in person as I move over to Coastal. But as long as I'm able to do me and not, you know, garner too much animosity, like in a wrong direction,
right,
then I'm good. Like, this is a profession. This is what I want to be in, you know, long term. And of course, you know, life happens. So just like now, right? So life can happen where things can change and I'd be able to pivot. But for right now, that's, you know, those experiences with my mom, grad school and all that, like, this is what led me to be professor Dr. Malone.
It's really cool, Dr. Malone. And then that was a lot there. And you gave a lot of great advice. Even I'm learning still from you, you know. And also, you know, I always liked that you take things from the pop culture world, you know, from whether it's Push and Pee or whenever freshman year when all that stuff was happening with 6ix9ine, oh, yeah, and you brought that to class. And also, you hit a pretty mean gritty in class that one day. I think everyone was trying to figure out the answer. I think I was the only one that actually saw it.
Yeah.
But you know, Dr. Malone, one of the things I've always wanted to ask you, you know, they always say behind every great man is a great woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always wanted to ask, and you know, you've, in little conversations we've had, you know, you've told me, but I didn't realize that, like, your wife, like, you've been with her for many years. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I want to ask you is, like, what's the secret to have a longevity relationship like that? And is there, you know, what's the secret, pretty much?
What's the secret? So behind what the quote, you know, so behind every great man is a great woman. That's the general quote. And my wife is amazing. So Stephanie, she's amazing. High school sweetheart. You know, went to different colleges, and so I appreciated that because then we could have our own separate friend groups. You don't have to be on top of each other, and, you know, kind of just always be in each other's space. Like, allow y'all to be independent people. So I've been married, what, 10 years, going on 11 this year. And I mean, the thing is there has to be a lot of grace between, you know, you two as individuals. So, like, it's a partnership. There's give and take. There's mistakes that are made. And knowing that, you know, when you have that true kind of love that, you know, you got to be able to ride those rough patches. But you also have to let people be them. Like, I wasn't in love. I didn't get in love to change my wife. And my hope is that she didn't get in love to change me. It's more of like, you know, accept the person as they are and then wanting them to grow. And hopefully that you grow together. And so that's kind of been the biggest things I've learned being in a relationship with someone so 18, right? So I'll be 35 in May. So the person I was at 18 is not who I am, you know, coming into 35. And there's so many life things that have happened, you know, between Stephanie and I. So we went to different colleges, you know, she became a teacher while I was in grad school. So she had a professional career. She really enjoyed teaching. And then, you know, then I moved out here to South Carolina while she was still in Texas. And then she came over the year after. And so, you know, building a life in South Carolina has always been great, but, you know, it's, you know, having that partner that, you know, like, hey, when there's something going on, like, this is the person I can come to, I can confide in, and then we're going to figure it out. And also, you know, what worked for our parents is not going to work for us. We live in a different context, a different time. And so that's also something I would just tell people, like, you got to know what works particularly for y'all. So just because it worked out with your friend, it don't mean it's going to work out for you. Y'all are different people. And you also got to know yourself. You got to know your flaws, right? You got to know your strengths and things of that nature. And you got to know that of your partners, and you got to do your best to not try to exploit those things. You can explore them, but don't try to exploit them. I think that's very important. That's a very important part of any relationship, is that you know, be honest with yourself. If you can't be honest with yourself, how the hell are you going to be honest with your partner? So if you have these flaws, and just be open enough about them, because what I've learned in life is that you're going to be put in situations where those things can get exposed. You're going to find out who you are. You're going to find out who your partner is, and then how do you move on, over for there? But if you're talking about, you know, some traits, there's got to be grace on both sides. You got to know, you got to have healthy boundaries, even with your partner. So just because, you know, you're married and all that doesn't mean that you get to tell somebody something what to do, that they got to, you know, bend the knee to you. Everything. Like, no, like, y'all are two functioning adults. Should be able to be independent thinkers, but also just healthy boundaries. And so you can have your group of friends and do your thing and just keep the same energy with me, but then also know there's still a respect there, right? As long as y'all have your agreement, who cares what the world has to say, right? Because I think a big part of that too is people trying to impress other folks. Like, your marriage is your marriage. So like, one of the things I think about, and you know, I don't know, this is the greatest example, I think about Will and Jada Smith, right? So everybody got all these opinions about, like, their marriage is open.
Entanglement.
Like, but, you know, and Will recently came out and said, you know, there's never been infidelity in my marriage. And people are like, oh, you're lying, there's no entanglement. It's like, but look up what infidelity means. Like, that you're going out with a partner outside, you know, of marriage. Like, something, some kind of trust has been compromised. No one, you know, if they had an open marriage, they probably had an agreement about da 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 da. So is it infidelity if they already had an agreement about A, B, and C? But ultimately, it's their marriage. If he's saying that there was never any infidelity, why are you so concerned about it? All right. So I use those examples, like, they didn't let the outside world dictate what marriage meant to them. Whether you agree with it or not, it's irrelevant to them. Hey, just don't run your marriage like that. If they're happy with it, oh, that may not mean that's my marriage. That's not how my marriage works. But again, that's not my marriage.
Right.
That's not impacting how I live my life every day. And I think sometimes we get wrapped up into people aren't doing the things we want to do, so we want to make them feel better about it. Like, who are you? Like, get you some business. Like, or mind the business that pays you. Mind the business that pays you. And a lot of times we don't. A lot of times people want to tell everybody how to do their job. Like, no. And so when it comes to, like, my union, like, our union is our union. We do it the way we want to do it. If we're honoring each other, we've agreed upon these things, we've got the boundaries, and so what? Somebody's saying this, that, and third. Let's keep doing things that we're doing until it doesn't work, and then we can, you know, come to the table, see what's going on, and then move on. So a big part is also communication. Learning communication styles. You know, everybody works differently. It's more specifically like love languages. So I wouldn't, you know, if you, I believe in this concept of love languages. So acts of service, quality time, words of affirmation, you know, things of that nature. So knowing your love language, like how you receive it, and then knowing the love language of your partner. So some of us aren't proficient in those languages, right? Because the way that I understand love may not be the same way someone else does, right? I can't expect someone to be fluent in my language. So learning what your language is and learning what the other person's language is important as well. So like Stephanie, she's very big on words of affirmation. You got to tell her these things. Da, 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 da. Me, I already feel like I'm that dude already. And by nature of her being, we're like, I'm definitely that dude. Like, right. Like, it's fine. I'm like, I'm gonna watch out. Like, you know. So, but my thing is I'm more big on acts of service and like quality time. Like spending time together and doing things for me. That's the way I understand love. But for her, she's very big on, let's say, like physical touch or words of affirmation. So those aren't the ones that I feel love for me, but it's not about me, right? It's about what your partner takes and receives as love. So I have to make sure, you know, feels in touch. So if that's just like a hug or, you know, stuff like that. Or, you know, words of affirmation like, hey, you look beautiful today. Hey, you're doing this thing here. I love how you take care of, you know, our daughter, our house, stuff like that. But she doesn't have to give me words of affirmation. It's cool, like, you know, but that's not how I really see my thing. It's like quality time, et cetera. So, like, if she, you know, cooks or, you know, does all this stuff, like, things that help make my life easier and, you know, as far as, like, work and stuff, trying to balance all this stuff, cool. She understands my language. Quality time, so we're just chilling. You know, if we go to restaurants, stuff like that, or we even talk, stuff like that, those are the things that, you know, I'm like, okay, cool. Like, I feel valued. I feel appreciated, blah, blah, blah. And so learning, like, what people's love languages are important. So not even in those intimate relationships, but also your friendships. Learning what people need to feel valued, to feel appreciated. I think that's important. And so, you know, so even when I'm in a classroom with y'all, like, I don't think I know everybody's particular love language, but I think words of affirmation does work well, especially for young folks, like feeling, you know, hey, this person validating me as a, you know, as a student, as a professor. So I know that's very important. So I do my best not to ever try to demonize my students, right? I don't ever want y'all thinking that you aren't capable. I want to provide constructive criticism, like, hey, remember, this is about the assignment. This isn't about you as a person. So trying to, you know, depersonalize it, right? We're working to critique the work, not you as a person, and work through there, because that's even tough as a professor. I'm sending out manuscripts for publication, and they will chop you apart. I'm like, are you chopping Danny the person apart, or just Dr. Malone and what you're doing as manuscript? And so making that separation. But when it comes to, you know, the relationship, at least with my wife, it's been one where, again, you're talking about someone that you've been together almost half my life. We have ebbs and flows and things of that nature, but the whole idea is, like, you know, is it a make or break for a lot of stuff? No. And you got to decide what that is for you. But yeah, she's definitely been a big part of my life, and, you know, half my life, and been a part of some of the greatest times of my life. And obviously, the big ones, like our daughter, but, you know, also us graduating college. So her being, you know, first generation American, so her parents, you know, came from Mexico, and, you know, her and her sister, so being, you know, going through college, graduating the whole American dream, like, they did that. That's been pretty cool to be a part of all those events. And so now she gets to, you know, spend, like, you know, almost every waking moment with the daughter. She's not, you know, teaching remotely online, which is what she does now, versus being in the classroom. And so I'm just trying to be the best, you know, husband and father I can be, you know, for her, and try not to be a detriment. Cause I mean, my wife is awesome. I don't know who would not like her. It's more me. I'm like, if they don't like her, it's because something I did. Because she, again, she has a very gentle personality. She's very introverted, you know? So I'm like, man, how do you deal with me? Cause, like, yeah, I've been this extrovert, you know, for a good amount of our time. But, you know, she, you know, likes to keep, you know, keep to herself, but she's really close to her family and stuff like that. And when she does get out, we'll be out for a little bit. Then it's like, okay, I can kind of tell, like, it's going back. All right, y'all, we're about to bounce. And that's cool, because that helps me too, because sometimes I probably need to be bouncing too. Because I do like social gatherings, especially when it's a good time, folks. But also, I even want to pull back, and she kind of, you know, her being around helps me with that. But yeah, she's amazing, and I hope, you know, the work that I do reflects in part, like, you know, of her being my partner, you know, and my wife and my best friend, trying to build this life that we both can be proud of and our families be proud of. So while I don't try to seek validation from my family, you do want your family to be proud of what you're building, and knowing that the principles and things they gave to us from both sides of the family, because our family have commonalities, but they also have differences. But I think we've both been able to kind of mesh things together and, like, really create something that's our own that has influence from her family and, you know, mine. I don't know if that answered your question.
Oh, yeah, Dr. Roman, it did. And that's awesome. I mean, it's something I've always wanted to ask you, because I know you've kind of, we talked about it a little bit, and I was thinking, like, man, that's so rare nowadays to, like, you know, to marry, like, your high school sweetheart and to, like, you know, and go through life with.
And for it to work. And like I said, you know, and we have had, you know, ebbs and flows where it's just like, man, like, this is real. Like, it could, you know, it could be really something. But, you know, I think the big thing is just kind of trying to keep the first things first, not trying to shackle each other. And it's probably more immediate than I'm like, look, I'm going to do me. Not like I'm out there being crazy or nothing like that, but as long as I don't feel like someone's trying to kind of shackle me and put me in a box, I'm good. And I think that's, whether it's been my parents, whether it's been her, or even the academy, I'm not going to allow it to happen. And so once I feel like something like that's happening, I'm very quick to kind of tug away and do my own thing until people figure it out. I've always kind of been that way. I think as I got older, as I started to get out of high school, I'm like, okay, this is the kind of big conformity piece. I'm like, I'm not conforming to that. So I'm going to be a rebel with a cause, so to speak. And my cause is not trying to be stripped of my authenticity. And I'm like, I'm going to do this, have my flaws, and just deal with it. And that's something that even she's had kind of learned. Like, I just let Denny do him, as long as, again, it doesn't disrespect the boundaries and things of that nature. I'm going to let Danny be Danny, as long as he's keeping things in respect, blah, blah, blah. And that's something that, you know, you just have to learn about people. That's something I would tell anybody. If you're in a relationship, don't try to change folks. It's hard enough for you to change yourself. How do you think you're going to try to change somebody else?
right. No, there's 100% truth to that. But, Darren, and something else that I wanted to ask you, you know, for you, right? Like, I know we touched on it a little bit earlier, but, you know, for being born in California and growing up in Houston, Texas, and then, you know, coming to South Carolina, you know, I know one of the things that you've always kind of like encouraged students and even me to, you know, travel, go see other places, go try to become, you know, a better version of you. And if you come back, cool. If you end up liking it somewhere else, that's, you know, that's great. That's fine. Also, yeah. I think one thing's what I'm trying to ask is, you know, was it ever hard for you to like leave Houston, to leave family and come like move all the way to another state, you know? Because that's something I've thought about. Like, I'm just like, you know, the idea sounds cool, but I'm just like, I don't know. you know, leaving family and friends behind, that's not, you know, the easiest thing to do.
Right. Well, so that one, it's a great question. And one, it ties back to childhood and some decisions that were made that I wasn't okay with, but it dealt more sacrifice, and I'll get into that. So the short of it, no, it wasn't, and it's because of what I'm about to explain. So, again, to my parents, being disciplined in the house, like, you do things your way, my way, highway, and, you know, as long as my house is my rules, okay. But if you do the right things in life, you should be able to get what you want. So, go through high school. My brother goes to California during, like, my sophomore year, I think. And so I go through the rest of high school without my next youngest brother, who I've been in school with. We've been in the same grade because I went to pre-first, so they caught him up. So by the time I got to first grade, he was in first grade. People are like, they're not twins. Like, no, I'm a three first, and, you know, so that's a little chip on my shoulder about that. Like, oh yeah, I think I was good enough. And so now, you know, I'm just, you know, that's probably where the know-it-all stuff started. Like, these people thought I was dumb. So now I got to sit here and try to overcompensate because I probably some insecurity there, very young, being told that you feel like you're not good enough. And so I was killing academically, right? Just, I'm not saying I was a super all A student, but I was A, B, you know, I was above average. And so I did do all that. My brother leaves to California in my sophomore year. So then now, you know, I'm doing high school by myself. And, you know, I got TJ, who's, you know, younger in elementary. So I'm doing a lot of stuff by myself. Working, grinding. So I'm swim team, you know, junior year, freshman year, all the way to senior year. So freshman letter, all that stuff in swimming. Rode the bench and football, but played football. And so got the grades, so I'm like right under top 10%. So in the state of Texas, if you're in top 10% of your class, you get automatic acceptance to schools in Texas and blah, blah, blah. Well, I didn't want, like, I actually wanted to leave. Like, I wanted to leave Texas. You know, I did all the right things. So I wanted to apply to Stanford for engineering. And then I wanted to also apply to Morehouse, which is HBCU. In Atlanta, and that's where Dr. Martin Luther King went. You want to guess what his bachelor's was in?
What's that?
Sociology. Mm-hmm. There you go. So shout out to sociology. But, you know, I wanted to leave the state because I wanted to leave and just, again, I already kind of built this kind of independence idea. I'm very independent, self-sufficient, very young, and I did things the right way. I had a job, You know, I wasn't getting arrested. Like, you know, I was doing everything that the, whatever this concept of goody two shoes and I was at. I fit that to a T because I knew what my parents expected and I did it. Didn't mean I wasn't getting into stuff. It was more of like, if I was doing stuff, they weren't going to find out. I just didn't let trouble follow me home, which is something my dad would always say. And that was a way to, you know, hey, don't want you getting into anything, but don't let it follow you home. So I wore the goody two shoes, did all that good stuff. So I'm thinking I've earned this opportunity. Also, you have to remember my brother's in California and he didn't earn that opportunity. He went out there because he was, you know, doing whatever. Like he wanted to reconnect with his dad. Cool, whatever, his father. So you have to think about it from the understanding of like 17, 18 year old scene. It's like, oh, so I get to leave too, right? But actually, I'm doing the right stuff. I'm doing everything you ever told me to do. And so ultimately, my mom was like, no, you're going to stay in the state of Texas. Da, 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 da. I don't want y'all leaving the state. Or I don't want you leaving the state. And, you know, it's kind of like crushed. Like, what do you mean? Like, I did the right thing. Da, da, da. But again, my house, my rule. So, you know, I just, at some point, I didn't even apply to either one of them because I was going to need my parents to help me apply. And if you're saying no, then I'm supposed to respect my parents. Da, da, da. Okay, cool. So I always tell people I settled on Texas A&M. So I had a couple of teachers at A&M. I really liked them. Shout out to Mrs. Laughlin and now Dr. Tony Ivy. She was Mrs. Ivy in high school, but she is a professor at Oklahoma State University. And so both of them are A&M. You know, they're Aggies. They're alums, and they had Mrs. Laughlin was my algebra teacher, and Dr. Ivy taught me integrated physics and chemistry. And so they're both Aggies. And so I was like, well, okay. Like, I'll apply there. But then also I applied to the University of Texas. The reason I applied there because my girlfriend now wife, applied and was already accepted. And funny thing is they accepted me first before A&M. But I knew the only reason I applied was because my girlfriend was going. I was like, I'm not going to go there just because it seems I only did it because my girlfriend was.
Right.
So I ended up choosing A&M. And this is just under 100 miles away from Houston, Texas. So, you know, that makes my mom happy. So not too far, you know, from her, but I'm far enough away. And again, you know, I went there for engineering. And that experience was cool. But my college experience is different because a part of it was just, I didn't get what I wanted when I felt like I deserved my chance to leave because I earned it. So, people want to hear it. Well, I didn't know that happened, Danny. Yeah, it happened. But no one at A&M really knew because it didn't matter. Like, the decision was made, and I remember just when I got my diploma and graduated, and my parents told me, I said, you know what? I don't want any help. I'm good. Like, y'all did what y'all supposed to do. Pretty much leave me alone, and I'm going to take care of my business. And I did. And so I went to A&M, did what I was supposed to do. You know, then it's time for grad school. I mean, I just got into sociology like in my junior year, essentially. So I only had 2 years, and I was like, okay, I like the professors, and, you know, I'll just continue grad school here. Do grad school, and then now it's time for the job. And of course, like I said, I got recruited by a former associate, and it's South Carolina. And so part of it was, again, a lot of it was helping this person. The person was here a few years before me that, they've been in a program, they talked about some of the opportunities and challenges, and it was cool to work with someone that you knew that you were close with at one point. So a lot of the push was, because I wouldn't have known about Coker if it wasn't for the individual. And so I always say that. And so then I come out here and I'm like, okay, definitely a way. Like, I'm excited about that. I finally really get to leave Texas and live somewhere else. So in grad school, I went to conferences. So I went to DC, I went to Boston, I went to, New York. I went to California, so it's not like I never left the state of Texas.
Right.
It was more to live, and so to actually kind of live somewhere else was actually pretty neat. Though it's rural South Carolina, like I said, it's definitely different than Greens Point, Houston, Texas. Definitely different than College Station Bryan, where A&M is located. But it was cool to get away, get a sense of a different culture, different folks, just different ways of life, and. And so that's been cool as far as just being away and just being kind of disconnected to some degree, from Houston, just so I can continue just to really, do me. So I didn't have any fear, so to speak. Like I was wanting to get out, and a lot of that was because I was held back from doing it earlier. And I think had I not been held back, maybe I would have been ready to just to come back after everything was done. But because I wasn't, now I'm in that phase, like, again, I'm a real world cause, right? It goes back to what I said, like, if you try to get me to conform to something, I'm going to find a way to try to break. And so now I'm in that phase where I'm breaking. And I had an opportunity to go back for another position, like, you know, in Texas. And I just, this the opportunity here is, you know, more fitting for what I'm trying to do. And so I'm continuing to be out here. But yeah, I don't know, as far as going back to Texas, you know, I go back and visit. But right now, I like what I'm doing out here. My family can fly, you know, they can fly out and drive out. They want to see us. And, you know, we can drive us a long drive. I mean, from here is 16 and a half hours, and I do it all in one stint. And that was before I had my daughter, and still we did that when we were back in December. You know, we stopped for food and stuff like that, you know, driving throughout the night so my daughter could sleep for a good amount of it. And again, wife's really MVP because she's backed up there in the seat. She's sleeping uncomfortably, but I'm driving the whole way. But, you know, right now, you know, South Carolina's where it's at for me. But I would definitely encourage students, like I encourage y'all, like, leave. And, you know, get these different experiences. And if you want to really improve the quality of place, come back. You know, like in the song, you know, the show goes on, Lupe Fiasco has a line there. It says, you know, you leave, you don't come back until you learn something. And so I think that's very true. Like, if you really love this place, then go find some things that this place isn't doing. You know, go somewhere, learn it, and then bring it back. And I just think that's important. So let's say, you know, life happens, pivots in a particular way, and I go back to Texas. Well, I've had so much experience outside of the state, outside of, you know, of where I'm from, where if I ever do come back, I'm definitely making a positive impact. I'm definitely bringing things that people may not be aware of. And that's because I've been at a private liberal arts institution and wearing so many different hats in this space. And now I'm going to go to a public institution where the apartments are a lot bigger. The place is a lot bigger. So having to learn just that way. And then if something else pivots in my career, then I'll be able to take experiences from Cobra and Coastal and then go elsewhere if that happens. But definitely leave, get these experiences, be around different people, try different foods. just because you've always done it one way doesn't mean it's the best way. And it's cool to learn how to do different things different ways. It allows you more versatile. Helps with problem solving skills, different ways to troubleshoot, critical thinking, all these type of tangible skills that employers want. And so also you get to see that, you know, I guess they have the quote, the saying that the distance makes the heart grow fonder. Maybe you really find out, damn, I really was taking these things for granted and you didn't know until you left. And that's like, you know, you can ask people when I went home, like, I really felt like, you know, home meaning like Greens Point. So it's not just my parents, like friends, people, lifelong friends we had. Like, it was a great feeling because there's so much going on, you know, around me to where when I went home, I was like, I really want to feel this like all the time. Just smiles galore, you know, watching my wife smile, be happy, my daughter. I'm like, this is, you know, this is what you want, you know, through and through. Just different feelings of people who have, you know, kind of seen me matriculate through grad school and mature throughout life and them seeing me now. And they should be just the same. I'm Danny from Greens Point. I'm not Dr. Malone and people put you on this pedestal. Like, no, that's Danny. He's always been like, you know, he's been goofy. Like, he was funny. you know, it's corny stuff. Like, he's still him. And for them to see that, it does matter to me a lot. That, you know, he didn't change because he got some titles, some letters on the end of his name. Like, he's still the same person. And he'll still come to the kickback with folks. He'll still chop it up. And, you know, he's still him. And so that's, if I move back home, it's really, so I can really get that kind of home feel. But also, the other side of that, which I don't tell students, even when you do go back home, you have to remember there are people there who haven't moved on, who haven't done much, so that envy and jealousy can be there too. And that's the danger also of going back home. So you got folks that, you know, they haven't fared well in life, and they see you've done all these things, you went around the world, you come back. And at first it starts dry heating on you, then it gets real wet, right? Like ocean wet heat. Like it's just, it's there, it's out there. And so I would tells them to be aware of that too. And, you know, it comes in the form of jokes, quote unquote, but no, you hating on me, you're trying to slide in as a joke, it's passive aggressive, stuff like that. So I would say watch out for that too. Because I've experienced some of that too. I'm just like, yeah, you kind of hating on me, so I need to fall back. Because you're really happy for me and proud. You ain't doing any slick hate stuff. You're not doing that. But if you're doing all the slick hate stuff, then I need to watch out because you know. If I keep letting it go, you're just gonna keep getting more bold, and I wanna nix that in the bud. So I'll also tell you be aware of that. But again, it's just haters, they gonna hate. There's people who haven't moved around and they're upset for whatever reason that you've done all these things and they haven't. It's like, you got to do some introspection, man. Like, I can't help that.
Right.
So I would say that's one of the things, like, a thing that would deter me from going back, it would be being around maybe folks that haven't, moved around enough, and, then they're all in their feelings because you have. And, that's one thing if someone's throwing it in your face, but at least that's not me. But there are folks that do. They want to throw it in your face. They want to make someone feel in spirit. Then I can understand where people want to react, but some people just have it in them because they don't feel like you deserve it for whatever reason. It's like, I'm going to stick back and stay away from that. But yes, travel the world, get these experiences, bring them back to your hometown, home place, and try to make, try to improve the quality of the place. Yeah, for sure.
Yes, sir. Dr. Malone, I just can't thank you enough for coming on this podcast. I'm very thankful to call you, to have had you as a professor, a mentor, and also to call you a friend. You will be definitely 100% be missed at Coker University, but we know that you're going to be shining and doing big things at Coastal, and they're very fortunate, and they should be thankful to have you as well over there. So, Dr. Malone, thank you so much for coming on.
Got my drink spilling. All these haters mad now because I've been winning. Yeah, I'm nice with it. Roll the dice with it.